Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Doing pretty well.
We want to talk today about an interesting thing that happened to a restaurateur and a chef who we know. He's a very interesting guy. A lot of controversy swirls around this fellow. His name is Fabio Traboki.
He's been on the show.
And we've eaten his food at Maestro in Washington when he was at a restaurant called Maestro in Washington, nationally renowned chef. He left Maestro, and a lot of articles appeared because, well, the whole kitchen staff left with him, causing Maestro to close. Now, if that was hostile, I got a problem with that. I don't think that's honorable. However, the hotel sought to put a good face on it. They said it was an amicable parting, and they were looking to rework the restaurant. Anyway, none of us know what happened with that. But there's a lot of buzz out there about Mr. Traboki, and a lot of people, I think, who maybe don't know the whole story, and I don't know anybody who does know the whole story, would conjecture that he, without the Maestro's knowledge, basically took their whole kitchen staff with him, like 16, 18 guys.
At which time they then closed. Now, there's some conjecture that they were going to close, and he's moving to Fiamma for a few years and then going back to that to Maestro.
So who knows?
So we don't know, but...
But there's a lot of talk.
I don't know.
A lot of gums yapping about that. So this is a guy who has very talented chef. We had a great meal down there. We ate in the kitchen there, didn't we?
No, he's got an open kitchen there.
But at Maestro,
he had an open kitchen.
Right. All right, so we had a lovely meal at the Maestro.
I've actually been there two or three times.
Haven't been to Fiamma yet. Mm-hmm. That's right. It was the other place where we ate in the open kitchen. We sat and had a big table, a wonderful cheese course. Yep. It was great. Well, what happened is recently he was given a great review. I think he got 3 stars in the Times. Mm-hmm. I think it was 3. It might have been 2. By Frank Bruni. Well, when he gave them 3 stars, he had Fiamma in New York. They had a 3-course price fixed menu at $75. That was late November of last year. By mid-February, Bruni gets reports that the 3-course price fix has gone up to $95.
It's a big jump.
And then it went down to 92, but it went from 75 to 92. His other menus went up. His a la carte menu, the 5-course menu, it doesn't give you an a la carte option. The 5-course menu went from $100 to $120. So he basically
raised all his prices 20% or more.
After all the reviews came in.
Now, is he using different ingredients? Are the tasting menus different?
Well,
word on the street is that they're not.
Well, not on the street. Bruni went back and wrote, it wasn't a review, wrote an article saying, hey, guys, I wrote this review based on this price point. And he talks about how I went back and the numbers changed. Well, you know what? I want to go open up. There is a philosophy that says open a restaurant, get
reviews. There was a philosophy, and this has certainly existed 15 years ago.
Okay? Still exists, I think.
And the philosophy basically was open your restaurant at a relatively inexpensive price point, get really good reviews for being a great value, and then you can slowly get your prices. As you develop your reputation, you can bring your prices up into the price with other restaurants of that caliber after you're known and after you get those initial reviews.
Well, and do you know what? Sometimes restaurants will open and you know, yes, we can look at it cynically and say, okay, the restaurant opened at lowball prices to get their reviews, and everybody said it was a great bargain, and you're out there, and then they raise their prices. Well, you know, that's one way of looking at it. But let's look at it from the other perspective for a moment. Very often, when you open a restaurant, you offer lower prices because you're not sure you've got it down yet.
Right.
And you can't afford to make any enemies.
Well, I also think it could be part of your marketing is that...
Let people see us.
Come try the food. You don't have to take that bigger risk to come and try the food because the prices are cheaper. I mean, Francis and I, when we opened our restaurant, now it was a much more relaxed, more casual restaurant when we first opened than it is now. But when we opened our restaurant, the prices were much less expensive than they are now.
But when we opened Catherine Lombardi, which we did in 2005, the way we dealt with that was to write on, we printed the menu prices on, and for the first month, we said, what was it, 20% off or 50%? We gave a discount.
We gave a discount.
And we said, okay, listen, we're only open a month and a half, 20% off everything, and it's not going to be perfect, okay? Part of what I think Bruni raises a point. Is someone trying to pull a bait and switch?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know about that. Because you open a restaurant, and now the media, the New York Times among the media, but the restaurant reviewers, all the reviewers want to scoop the other reviewers. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to be first to open your restaurant, to review your restaurant. So somebody comes in, and they review your restaurant within 3 weeks of you opening,
mm-hmm.
2 weeks of you opening, you're talking about, you know.
Well, bloggers are sometimes there 5 days into your opening writing blogs about you.
Yeah, but the difference with bloggers is blogs write a review about your restaurant, and then the blogger can change that review at a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the New York Times reviews their restaurant.
Right, they're not coming back for 3 years.
They're not coming back for 3 years. And so New York Times, New York Magazine, Time Out New York, they all want to be the first to review this restaurant. Well, is that fair?
Right.
I mean, so if a restaurant opens up and says, okay, I know I'm going to be reviewed, so I want to have lower prices for the reviews and then raise my prices for when the customers come in, maybe that's a way of looking at it. And maybe the way to look at it is, hey, you know what? I'm going to open up and everything's not going to be perfect, and I want to keep my prices low so everybody can try my food and see how good it is. And if the New York Times comes in or a reviewer comes in during that time period, well, I don't think it's necessarily malicious for someone to raise their prices later, because the assumption to me is also that while your service and food may be great in the beginning,
mm-hmm.
hopefully you're saying my service and food is going to be better 6 months after I'm open.
Sure,
a lot
and I
better.
Think in most restaurants that's the case.
And, you know, God bless the restaurateur whose service is on point from week two.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that a lot of restaurants would open at a lower price point, you know, feel where they are. And the other thing that can happen in a restaurant is you might open a restaurant, and we've done this when we were young restaurateurs at 26, 27 years old. You open a restaurant, and you say, okay, these are going to be my prices. And you run everything right, and you cut waste down to a minimum, and you do everything efficiently, and you find you're not making any money.
Mm-hmm.
And you're busy as can be, but there's no money on the bottom line.
Right.
And so you say, you know what, I need to raise my prices
20%. This is not sustainable. I can't stay in that. There's another factor, too. And the other factor is simple economic supply and demand. Okay? And if your restaurant's not full and you need it to be full, and you can make money at lower prices, you're going to lower your prices. And if your restaurant's full all the time and 7 nights a week and you can economically stand to raise your prices, well, that's what most companies are going to do. They're going to raise their prices.
Well, and the one point I want to drive home with this is being set up as Fabio Traboke pulled a bait and switch. And I don't think that's fair. Because I think especially when a reviewer, if the reviewers want to come in when a restaurant's a baby and it's brand new, and then they want to turn around a few months later and say, hey, you made changes?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they should be surprised at that. I think that's part of the game of not giving a restaurant 6 or 7 months or a year to get its feet under it.
I also think, though, it's fair, though, for Bruni to go back and say, you know what? This was $75 when I reviewed it. It's $92 now. Maybe things should change.
But you know what? And you know what? He published that, and then he published again the following Wednesday. Fabio Traboke said, okay, we'll lower our prices back down to a modest 5% increase, because basically he was forced into it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a much more complex issue than it would seem on the face of it. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. The rest of the show, we're going to be talking with a guy named Dan Koppel, who wrote this amazing book about bananas. You'd be surprised how important bananas are to international commerce, to the food on your plate. And they're tasty. So we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:16.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys from Stage Left and Captain Lombardi. Our guest today is Dan Koppel. His stories have appeared in National Geographic, Adventure, Wired, Audubon, and Popular Science. He's tried over 20 different kinds of bananas on 5 continents, an achievement in itself. He joins us today to discuss his wonderful book, Banana, The Fate of a Fruit That Changed the World.
Dan, welcome to the show. You know, I only have maybe 3 bananas under my belt, maybe 4 tops.
Three or four bananas total, you mean?
Yes.
Of different varieties.
Different varieties, exactly.
Well, you have a long way to go.
Indeed, I do.
Now, what inspired you to write a book solely about bananas?
Well, I originally wrote a magazine article totally about bananas, but it didn't include the totality of the world banana. And I became a little obsessed about bananas. And once I realized how many bananas there were and how much there was to know about bananas, and I became so obsessed I realized I'd better write a book or else I wouldn't have any other way to make a living.
Well, let's talk about the banana. The banana book is great.
Thank you.
I kept wanting to sing that song, that damn song, the whole time, the banana book, because it's so close to the banana boat. But the book deals with the banana itself and the banana as food and the banana as a crop, but it also deals with the politics of bananas. Let's talk about the banana as food and plant. The banana we currently know is not the banana that our parents ate in the 50s.
Yeah, that's right. And most people don't know this. The original banana that was imported to the U.S. and really introduced, it was completely foreign, alien, and unknown fruit to people up until about 1900, was a fruit called the Gros Michel banana. The one we eat is called the Cavendish, entirely different variety. The Gros Michel was a more delicious, bigger, heartier banana, but it was hit by a disease almost immediately after it was introduced. And by about 1960, it was completely extinct. And the banana that was the replacement banana, called the Cavendish, anyone who knows the old bananas and was a sort of banana enthusiast says that our Cavendish banana is kind of a bland, not-so-great banana, but it was resistant to this disease, and it was really the only banana that was available. And
at least it's still a banana.
Yeah, it's still a banana, although the big banana guys kind of would even scoff at that in some way.
Now, why was the Gros Michel, why are bananas particularly vulnerable to a disease that can make them go extinct so quickly?
Sure. Well, one of the things we love about bananas is that they're so consistent. Every banana is the same as every other one, and that's because bananas are clones. Every single banana that we eat is exactly the same as every other one genetically. They're identical twins, and that is the same all around the world. The banana that you might have sliced into your Cheerios for breakfast this morning is the same one, as I say in the book, as a fellow in Switzerland sliced into his muesli, or someone ate in Japan, or anywhere. So just like human identical twins, what afflicts one can afflict the other. And so when a banana gets sick, every banana can get sick. And so when a disease hits, they get wiped out very quickly. When bananas do get ill, as the Gros Michel did, it's very quickly these diseases spread and they go away.
The irony here, Dan, is that I actually did slice a banana into my Cheerios this morning.
Well, you and probably 50 million other people in the U.S. It's the most popular fruit in the United States and in the world.
We talk all the time about monocultures in crops and then about genetically identical animals for meat and dairy.
And how dangerous that is.
Why though is the banana? Why are all the bananas a monoculture? Is that just something that's natural to the banana?
Well, actually, there are over 1,000 different varieties of banana. But you have to remember, bananas grow in such quantities. Unlike some other fruits, they have to be shipped thousands of miles by boat. And unbelievably, in order to be shipped that distance, a banana has to have certain requirements. It has to be tough because it has to, as you know, bananas are pretty fragile. They bruise easily. So a banana to be shipped that far has to be tough enough to survive that shipment. It has to stay green so that when it gets to your supermarket, it's nice and green, but it has to ripen in about 7 days so that it lasts, in your fruit bowl. It has to have all these qualities: toughness, proper ripening characteristics. It has to taste right. And of that 1,000 bananas in the world, really only the Cavendish, one in 1,000 bananas, has those qualities. And so there really is no other fruit out there. And so we've got that Cavendish, and that's pretty much it as far as the banana companies are concerned.
No, but bananas don't sexually reproduce, right? I mean,
that's right, they don't.
how do bananas reproduce? What's in the secret sex life of bananas?
Well, the secret sex life, if you want to call it that, it's pretty pathetic if you want to call it a sex life. Bananas don't have sex. They're sexless. They're sterile. Bananas reproduce through a cutting, basically. That's kind of a simplified way to put it, but banana plants, you more or less take a cutting off one, or in the wild, they sort of a little, what they call a daughter plant, will grow off a mother plant, and a new tree will grow. And this is a great thing because it makes bananas very easy to grow, which is why in places like Africa, they're a very important staple food. But it also means that these daughter plants are, as I said, genetically identical to the mother plant. So they're very easy to afflict.
Well, Dan, is that true of all the different varieties of banana?
Pretty much. There are no varieties of bananas that people eat that sexually reproduce, that produce pollen. There are wild bananas out there that are inedible that do produce seeds and pollen. But wild bananas are very small and basically inedible. You would recognize them as bananas, but if you tried to eat one, you'd immediately get into one of those seeds, and the jungle you'd find them in would probably not have the dental clinic nearby that you would need once you bit into one.
When we come back, Dan, I want to talk about the Cavendish banana because that's now under threat as well, which you deal with in your book. So stick with us. We're going to come back and talk with Dan Koppel about his book, The Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Dan Koppel about his book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Now, we spoke before the break about the Cavendish banana is the current banana that's used. But that now, too, is under threat, right? Right, Dan?
Yeah, that's right. The very disease called Panama disease that wiped out that early banana, the Gros Michel, is now threatening the Cavendish. The Cavendish was adopted because it was believed to be immune. But a new strain of Panama disease is hitting the Cavendish crop in Asia. It has yet to hit the Cavendish crop that we eat, which is grown exclusively in Latin America. But every banana scientist I have spoken to in the past 3 years says it is not a matter of if, but when. And as I said before, there is no cure for this disease.
So they feel that the Cavendish banana that we are used to seeing, the most popular fruit in the United States, will go extinct.
It right now, unless something is done, unless a way to cure this disease or stop it or find an alternate banana that we can eat, as was done earlier, we will have a real banana problem sometime in the next 10 to 20 years, most likely.
Dan, we need a banana plan.
Yeah, we need a banana plan. And right now, as far as anyone can tell, there really is no banana plan.
Well, actually, when Alex, who did the research for us on the show, brought me your book, her notes, underlined and highlighted, and a banana, which I thought was kind of cute, but she brought me a red banana. What's the red banana all about?
Well, the red banana is, these are grown in Latin America. It's a relative of a banana grown in the Philippines called the Lacatan, which is an absolutely delicious, wonderful banana. And the red banana is a possibility, but you may have noticed that red banana isn't so red. It's kind of red and brown, and that's because it's a banana that ships very poorly. And if you cut into that banana, you'll notice it's very thin-skinned. And so The red banana is a possibility, but it would require some real technological shifts to get that banana in a place where it could replace the
shipping
25 wise. Million pounds of bananas that we Americans eat every year, because it really is a little too fragile. I'm guessing almost for certain that she bought that at a gourmet, like a Whole Foods market or something.
Dan, when we come back after the news, I want to talk about the importance of the organic banana and tell our listeners something they need to know.
And also the history of the Banana Republic. So you stick with us. Come back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Dan Koppel. His book is Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World and Changed the World That Did. Dan, you talk about the history of the banana and the American fruit companies and banana republics in Latin America. Can you sort of enlighten us about some of the things that were done in the name of American fruit companies and specifically the banana?
Sure, and it's a terrible history. These companies, which today are known as Chiquita and Dole, they did something miraculous. Until the banana came on the scene, fruit was local. You had apples, basically, and they came from a couple hundred miles. The banana companies decided they were going to sell for half the price of apples, and they were shipping fruit thousands of miles. To do this, they needed to basically control entire countries. They needed to have land and labor for more or less free. And to do this, when you get land and labor for free, you got to do some pretty nasty things, and they did. They took over countries, they suppressed workers, and they treated people pretty badly. They used private militaries, the U.S. militaries, dozens of times, starting around 1900 and continuing up through the 60s, to brutally suppress workers' movements and movements to just get some people basic care. There were massacres. There were just horrible suppression of uprisings. Men, women, and children killed.
What are some of the times that the American military was used in the service of fruit companies?
Well, one of the worst times was 1954 when the Guatemalan government was overthrown in a CIA-backed coup. The Guatemalans elected a democratically elected president, and he attempted to take back some land that Chiquita had owned for over 50 years. It wasn't even land that was being used. It was actually land that this disease had made impossible to use for banana companies. They couldn't grow bananas on it anymore. But the second he tried to take it back, the CIA directed a coup against him, and that led to almost 30 years of instability in Guatemala that claimed almost a million lives.
Well, but the banana companies did get their profits, right? That was when we
they got their profits,
and we got our bananas.
We got our bananas, and this is what led to these takeovers, are what led to the term banana republics.
So sometimes cheap food isn't so cheap in other ways. Sometimes other people pay the price.
Yeah, absolutely, and this is still happening today. Chiquita just recently paid a huge fine and pled guilty to supporting terrorist organizations in Colombia. They paid protection money. In order to maintain their banana plantations in places where terrorist organizations, described by the U.S. State Department, are operating.
So I think somebody wasn't really thinking when they used it, when they decided to name their company Banana Republic. Maybe that wasn't
I never quite understood that.
Not the best.
Well, no. So what they were convicted of, and I read about this, is they were convicted of paying money to terrorist organizations. So the terrorist organization said, "Okay, Chiquita, you got a lot of money. We'll leave you alone if you pay us protection money." And then they use that money, of course, to build bombs to kill other people.
Yeah, and not just Colombians. I mean, just a few days ago, there was a lawsuit filed in Florida. That money was used to kidnap American missionaries and murder them. Chiquita is being sued for that.
But the bananas are still cheap.
Yep, the bananas remain cheap, although the prices are going up now. But not because of terrorism, but because of flooding in Ecuador, your listeners have probably seen a 20 cent or so rise in bananas per pound since January 1st.
The treatment of the banana farmer and the people who these countries has been known for a long time. This really wasn't any big secret. Yet I think the public, before books like yours and a couple of others that have, you know, bananas have kind of been under public scrutiny recently. But it seemed like nobody in the public really knew any of this story. It seemed like it was just kind of quietly not talked about.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the case of the banana, I mean, very early on, Chiquita worked really hard to present a very sort of sweet image with the Chiquita banana symbol, and even before that, they wrote school textbooks. They positioned themselves as sort of bringing civilization to the savages, and this isn't anything new. I think, you know, we've often seen ourselves as bringing benefits, and the banana is such a sort of bland yet wonderful thing. It's for children and old people. I think it's very tough for us to associate this sort of wonderful, popular, you know, the New York Times called it the fruit of the masses back around 1910, with this thing that sort of also oppresses the masses. It's a very weird.
Well, it oppresses different masses. You have to use one mass against the other mass. Now, we've talked about government overthrows, CIA plots, stealing land, oppressing workers. But have they ever done anything really bad, like kill 1,000 people? Has anything like that ever happened in furtherance of the banana?
Sure. 1929, there was a banana strike in Colombia, and the workers were gathered in front of church on Sunday in a town square, and the Colombian military, at the behest of United Fruit, which was the company that became known as Chiquita, opened up machine guns and killed 1,000 banana workers and their families. When the massacre was over, the U.S. Ambassador wired back to the State Department and said, you know, I have the pleasure to inform you that the strike is over. The United Fruit representative has told me that 1,000 are dead and everything is back to normal.
So striking workers were just massacred.
Just massacred.
And their children and their wives.
Yeah, as they got walked out of church.
But the bananas.
And their bodies were thrown into the ocean.
But the bananas are cheap.
Yep, the bananas stayed cheap.
But that just goes, I want to make a larger point there. There are a lot of costs to a lot of the cheap food we have today that are externalized costs that maybe you don't pay at the market. But it's really hard to make informed choices today about where we buy our food in a way that is responsible. Is there a responsible way? Is there a more responsible way to buy bananas today?
Well, there's fair trade, which we don't have a lot of here in the U.S. Fair trade is a way that's very popular in Europe or getting more popular. I mean, in terms of bananas, it accounts for a fraction of the market.
Right. We see it in coffee and chocolate and things like that here in the United States, but
not
in things like bananas very often.
And it provides a sort of guaranteed level of profit and fair health care and things like that for the worker. It's very tough for bananas because the way we want bananas is cheap, and you can't give a lot of profit to workers when bananas are such a low margin. Bananas are an industry, Starbucks fair trade coffee costs about $14-$15 a pound, last I looked. You know, I don't know if people are willing to pay $3 a pound for ordinary yellow bananas, which is probably what they'd have to cost. We would really have to reimagine our idea of what bananas are, and I don't know if we're ready to do that.
Well, with the coming possible extinction of the Cavendish banana, we may be reimagining it anyway.
Right. Well, it might require reimagining. It would mean even a redefinition. It would be wonderful to see varietal bananas in our grocery store, a whole aisle of them, the way we have aisles of apples now. It would mean bananas not as, you know, we might not see them on the front cover of our Cheerios box. It would be an exotic fruit, which bananas actually are, outside of the tropics, or should be in a lot of ways.
You know, when we come back, I want to talk also about the healthfulness of bananas, because I do like bananas, and organic bananas may be the most important fruit for you to purchase organically, and there are several reasons why. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1145.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Dan Koppel about his book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World.
Dan, I've been hearing for a while now that bananas are one of the most important fruits to eat, organic produced fruits. And that's kind of counterintuitive because we don't eat the peel. There are other fruits for which we eat the peel. Can you tell us why that's such an important thing?
Well, bananas, because they're so susceptible to disease, require, I mean, it's not just Panama disease. There's about a dozen diseases that are controllable through incredible amounts of pesticides and fungicides and other means. So to grow organic bananas without all that stuff is really important. And it's not important for us because you're right, that stuff doesn't get through the peel, but it's really important for the workers. The stuff that's used to control pests for bananas is really, really toxic even today. And so if we can find organic bananas, it's a huge boon not for us, but for the people who grow them.
Well, what happens there are pretty well-recorded effects of the use of those kinds of pesticides on the workers there. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. And the biggest effect right now today for the stuff that's used is sterility, cancer. Even today, banana workers in some countries, especially Ecuador, which has poor worker protection laws, is just reduced lifespan. Our banana workers' lifespans can be reduced by as much as 20 years. Age 55 can be the maximum in parts of Asia. We're basically saving lives. It's as simple as that. I could go through a list of diseases, but that's all you really need to know.
So banana worker probably has about the same life expectancy as somebody about 2,500 years ago.
Yeah, that's not uncommon for any kind of agricultural worker in the third world, but we eat more bananas than anything else, so, effectiveness of our choices is very maximized with bananas.
Another point we have to make our listeners know as well is the peel of a banana is porous, and some of those pesticides do penetrate and get into your banana.
Some of them can. Again, bananas are probably safer than most other fruits, but yeah, of course, whenever you're eating something that's been doused in chemicals, you know, it's not the greatest thing.
As well as you handle them.
Right, of course.
Now, an interesting fact I found in your book is that the banana tree is not really a tree at all. It's an herb. It's a giant herb.
Yeah, that's right. The banana is the world's largest herb, and that it's not a tree at all. And that thing you might call a trunk is actually not a trunk. It's more or less a stem.
It's a hell of a stem, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and in fact, it's not even a stem. In fact, the proper term is a pseudostem. So, we're getting down to nitpicking. But
what
makes
a tree a tree and an herb an herb?
Well, what makes a tree is bark, and there is no bark and no branches on a banana tree, so that's a stem, just like a flower has a stem and no bark. And the banana itself is actually the remnants of a flower. The banana is actually a berry. So
banana's a berry.
Yeah, we're getting deeper and deeper.
That's awesome. All right, well, I want to talk about one thing that we used to have when we first opened the restaurant. We have a wood-burning grill, and we used to take maple syrup and store it above the wood-burning grill, mm-hmm. So it got all smoky, and then we'd put macadamia nuts in there, and we'd make wet macadamia nuts.
And roasted macadamia nuts, not just macadamia
right.
nuts.
Right, and then we would, and our first menu, when our restaurant was a lot more casual than it is now, we had on the first dessert menu a smoked maple wet nut banana split that was just incredible. And it was just, it was lined up in a banana boat, banana split boat with, you know, the thing split down the side.
We fried the banana just for a moment. Dusted in a little Wondra and dropped in the fryer for just a moment.
So while there is the classic banana split and the Francis and Mark crazy banana split, you know, banana split's sort of like a classic American icon that we sort of reinterpret, but banana splits are pretty good. What's the history of the banana split?
Well, it's a murky history. There are at least four places in the United States that claim to have invented the banana split. A couple in Ohio, a couple in Pennsylvania, one in Pennsylvania, one in Delaware, all between 1900 and 1910. At least two of those towns have banana split festivals celebrating their so-called invention. The truth will probably never be known, but the earliest claim is around 1904. Now it's a universal treat, pretty much the recipe's the same, three scoops, three toppings, and the split banana on either side.
And Francis and Mark's world, the wet macadamia.
Oh, so good. Ridiculously good.
Yeah, yours sounds pretty good.
And if you fry the bananas just a little bit,
Ridiculously good. I know what I'm having for my secret treat tonight. Banana peels. There are still today... Right now, there are laws on the books about disposal of banana peels.
Yeah, that's right. They're kind of like blue laws right now. But back in the day when bananas were first introduced, there were no sanitation systems, and bananas became so popular that slipping on banana peels became a genuine hazard. And there were laws enacted that specifically prohibited throwing away banana peels. Like in St. Louis, there was one that said it is illegal to dispose of a banana rind on the street, and people actually slipped on them. Now, by about 1910, the laws were effective enough that people weren't slipping anymore, and it became sort of a gag, you know, the pie in the face kind of gag, and it, you know, spread to the movies, and so now we think it's a funny joke. But back in the day, bananas were so new, and no one knew what to do with those peels, and people would throw them away. They'd rot and slip, and
I just can't imagine walking down the street, and I don't care if I knew what a banana was or not, just throwing away that big peel on the sidewalk. I just can't imagine that.
I have a very funny banana peel story, but maybe we should say goodbye to Dan first.
Dan, got to ask you a question before we go. We only have about 30 seconds left, but you've tasted more bananas than anybody I know, over 20 varieties, right, would you say?
Yeah.
So what's the best banana in the world, and where do you get it?
Philippine Lacatan, no question. You get it in the Philippines, but if you want to stay in this hemisphere, the slightly sour Brazilian Prata, an acquired taste, but worth the wait. Go down there and get one.
Book your flights, everybody. Go to cheapfares.com. They're not a sponsor yet, but maybe they will be. Dan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Dan.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Dan's book is The Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. You can find out more about it on our website, and you can even order it on our website, restaurantguysradio.com.
And I really do have a banana peel story.
So don't go away. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the restaurant guys. Yes, Mark?
A banana peel story. I promised you a banana peel story you shall have.
I don't have any, so...
Apparently, my wife and kids were out sitting on the front stoop one day, and my two-year-old had a half a banana that she was eating, and my wife went off chasing one of the other children, and all of a sudden, she couldn't find the banana. They had to rush off to somewhere, noticed that the banana was gone. They had to rush off somewhere, got everybody in the car, off she went.
And your two-year-old's a bit of a terror, isn't
she? She's a little bit of a terror.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, an hour later, it's got to be longer than that. It's got to be a couple hours later. I'm off to go to work or wherever I'm going. And as usual, I go out the front porch and down the first couple of stairs with a pile of things in my arms, because I always have books or magazines or something that I need to be reading or doing or transporting from one place or another. Well, so I'm not looking at the ground. And I'll tell you, I hit the bottom step of my front stoop.
Oh.
And like a cartoon character, okay, up in the air I go. Bam, land on my back. I'm in the middle of the driveway, and I'm laying there a little bit dazed, but I know I'm not really hurt. Okay, I know that I've just landed on the softest part of my body, so I'll be okay.
Your head.
And I look over, and I see on the ground a banana peel. and I'm laying on the ground, and I'm laughing hysterically, laying on the ground.
My uncanny camera.
And actually, what I'm actually thinking is, it's a shame that there was no one around to see that, because that could have provided humor forever for somebody to have that visual in their head of me slipping on that banana. And I will tell you a fact about the banana peel. A rotting banana peel is not very slippery.
Yeah.
A rotting banana peel with half a rotting banana in it is extraordinarily slippery. And that's the answer.
Thanks for amusing me at the end of the show.
I can give you one small, more tiny little add-on to this story. Later in that night, I'm interviewing a candidate for a job, and I put my foot up on my knee, and I look down, and I see there's just a little bit of smushed banana just by the heel of my shoe, and I couldn't help but think of that episode of The Sopranos where after Tony's knocked somebody's teeth out, he finds a tooth in the cuff of his pants later
and
that
there,
day.
And therein lies the difference between you and James Gandolfini. Hope you enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.